I'm Matt Lerner, and I have the honor of being your presider this morning. I'm going to take almost none of your time because we have some fantastic presentations for you today. I have been tasked, however, with at least in advance trying to give you a flavor for what you're about to see. First of all, in terms of the uniting theme, I've asked to give you the uniting theme of what we're seeing here this morning. And if you notice here, these are ostensibly scientists, but for those of you who can't read, it's some scientific equations, then a miracle occurs, and then some more things happen. And what's great about all of the work that we're seeing here today is, as far as teaching, each of the folks you're going to see are trying to describe what that miracle is. They're trying to show the miracle that they're able to bring to life between the input process of creating curricula and running classes and the output of student learning, and trying to describe and understand that in a way that's beyond miraculous. How's that? So as far as common threads we're seeing today, I had the opportunity to read through these slides, and I really identified three, but I'm hoping in the discussion we can come up with many more. One is that each of these different presenters today focus on observation in various ways, either observation of each other, observation of learning processes, observations of teaching, in different ways. Second is reflection, either others reflecting back on teachers to help them become more aware, or processes of self-reflection. And finally, it says teaching with love. I don't know if you can read that. But teacher sensitivity, and in various different ways, either trying to measure that quantitatively or qualitatively, and ensure that the teachers that are part of these programs that we're talking about are demonstrating sensitivity, because as the body of research that's developing has shown, teacher sensitivity can be a powerful predictor of student learning. So in terms of who our presenters are, we are very lucky today. Our first presenter is Robert Pianta, the Dean of the Curry School of Education here, as well as the Novartis U.S. Foundation Professor of Education and a professor in the Department of Psychology. He serves as the director of the National Center for Research in Early Childhood Education and the Center for Advanced Study of Teaching and Learning. Dr. Pianta's recent work focuses on the assessment of teacher quality, teacher-child interaction, and child improvement using standardized observational assessment and video feedback. He has also recently begun to extend his work into design and delivery of professional development using web-based formats and interactive video. Dr. Pianta has published more than 350 scholarly papers and is the lead author on several influential books on early childhood and elementary education. He's going to be talking about using observation to improve teaching and learning. So we are very lucky to have him here. He also organized this entire conference that we're at. So you picked a good symposium to be in. Second, we have Yitna Ferdiwick and Emily Skida. Yitna Ferdiwick is the faculty consultant in instructional technology here at UVA. There's a faculty consultant in that. And Emily Skida, meanwhile, is an associate professor of Spanish and director of the Spanish and Italian language programs. She holds an MS from Georgetown University and MA and PhD from Cornell. Her areas of research include teacher development, technology integration, assessment, applied linguistics, comparative romance linguistics, and historical syntax. And in addition to teaching courses in Spanish linguistics and foreign language pedagogy, she's director of the Summer Language, there she is, Institute for Spanish and Italian, and summer session chair. Professor Skida was appointed to the Daniels Family NEH Distinguished Professor and was a 2001-2002 University of Virginia Teaching Fellow. And she's going to be speaking about assessment of teaching and learning through video. And finally, we are especially honored to have several colleagues of mine in psychology, so ambitious graduate students who are committed to teaching, who have, in addition to being phenomenal top scholars, upcoming scholars in the areas of clinical, cognitive, and developmental psychology, here we have specifically cognitive and developmental represented, they decided that teaching in psychology at the graduate level needed to be focused on and improved, and so they've created the graduate teacher training program, and in the spirit of evidence, focused on analyzing and improving graduate student teaching of psychology. And now I'm going to take none of your time, and we're going to see some examples of best teachers, starting first with our own Bob Pianta.
I'm going to drive through some slides that describe work we've been doing in the K-12 world, And as illustrative of the ways in which we've used observation and standardized observations to drive improvements of teaching. So we'll have to, this is all by way of analogy in terms of the application to higher education, although we are doing some of this work now in community colleges. So our work is largely organized around leveraging teachers as game changers. Right now we have a lot of fairly good evidence that getting a good teacher, however we might define that, is really a matter of luck in the K-12 system, that that they are a rarefied commodity and kids essentially luck into them. Our approach has been to, in a sense, of approach the challenge of improving teaching through the scientific study and to deal with measurement and then using measurement to produce good teaching. And in the consequence of that, develop a set of valid and effective tools for school districts. We're very much oriented around this notion of observing teacher behaviors that we've identified as linking to learning, then proving that they link to learning in many thousands of classrooms, and then replicate that that connection. We use a system called the Classroom Assessment Scoring System. And then the idea being that if you can identify those variables or those teacher behaviors that are effective in producing learning, you've replicated those results, then the next task is to engineer a set of professional development supports to produce those behaviors, whether those be in teachers practicing in the field or even in higher education. And our work at CASEL really tries to connect this notion of observation and measurement to professional development to improve teaching and learning. So we're focused on teacher-student interactions in three broad domains: the kind of emotional supports that teachers provide to kids, the way they organize the classroom and the instructional environment, and then what they do with what we call instructional support. And those are a set of behaviors that are really oriented around pressing kids' cognition. So it's not just the delivery of a lesson, it's really how teachers give feedback and push conceptual understandings and cognition. The class is a tool that observes and rates interactions between teachers and kids on a 1 to 7 scale. So we quantify those interactions, low on the 1 side, 7 on the high side. We've developed versions of this that go from pre-kindergarten all the way to 12th grade, and we focus a lot on the common denominators of teaching across all of those broad the broad differences that can be represented there. And as I said, we measure these aspects of their behavior. Right now, it's used in a lot of different applications in teacher professional development. It is the instrument that we've developed is actually the standard, the gold standard for the quality of classroom environments and head starts across the country in a number of different states, and we do a lot of research with it. It, as I said, it's organized around these three broad domains that run down the left. Each one of those domains is indicated by a dimension of behavior that we watch in when we watch teachers interact with kids in the classroom. That these are the what we call dimensions along the left side, and those are the things that we assign a score to when we're actually measuring what we're observing in classrooms. And I want to call attention to this measurement, the way we approach measurement, because again, we have this broad domain, and we talk about the domain as being consistent across pre-K to 12 and across all the content areas that a teacher might teach. So we're trying to capture kind of a lumper by nature. So we're trying to capture a lot of what could be included in the broad range of emotional supports that teachers provide to kids. The dimension that we talk about is sensitivity as an indicator of emotional support. But then we talk about very clear behavioral indicators and behavioral markers that translate those broad terms into actual observable behaviors in the classrooms. At the end of the day, you know, we've got to be able to go into a classroom, observe reliably. Everybody's got to agree that we've been able to see this score and the way we would assign that score. And so it's through the articulation of very specific behaviors that are assigned at different levels, low, medium, and high, that we've developed this instrument. So another thing about this is that we'll talk about emotional support and teacher sensitivity as aspects of teacher-child interaction that are consistent from pre-K world to the 12th grade world, but it's those indicators and behavioral markers that change over time. So obviously, you demonstrate your sensitivity differently if you're interacting with 3-year-olds than if you're interacting with 13-year-olds, if you can manage it with 13-year-olds. Okay. So we spend a lot of time. So in the K-12 world, as in the higher ed world, there's all sorts of observation that we do of teaching. We pay almost no attention to the technical properties of those observational instruments. In the K-12 world, principals do drive-by, walk into classrooms, they assign ratings. Another principal might walk in at the same time, another school leader might walk in the same time, see the same behavior, come up with entirely different scores. In our view, those scores are not very useful. Certainly not useful for moving lots of systems forward in improvement. And so we've gone through an awful lot of work to build a technical body of knowledge that proves the ways in which one has to go through a set of standardized training regimes and the efficiency of those regimes to come up with a score that at the end of the day, at the bottom point here, functions as a reliable and valid indicator of teacher effectiveness that then can be used in inferences for hiring, firing, tenure, professional development. Because in our world, the K-12 world, as would probably be the case in higher ed, increasingly the measures of teacher performance are being moved into an accountability framework. And so it's really important that those technical properties are present. Okay, so we've observed well over 8,000 classrooms across the country. It's very extensively used, and we've been able to demonstrate quite clearly that teachers who have higher scores on our observations are teaching kids. The kids in those classrooms are making more progress. And I just want to illustrate some of these, what we're finding nationwide. So these are smooth frequency distributions from low to high on what we find in the three broad domains. And here you see that classrooms are modestly supportive and organized, but those elements of instructional support and teachers' behavior that really drive kids' cognition are notably low in most classrooms across the country. That's a finding that replicates in pre-K as much as it replicates in 11th grade. We see almost no difference in the distributions there. Interestingly, we have found that if you can create professional development or land in a classroom in which a teacher is to the right side of that red bar that I just dropped there on the instructional support, those are classrooms in which kids are demonstrating considerably greater gains in the achievement. We've also found that this is sort of a sign of kids who come in classrooms with adjustment problems or no adjustment problems. The kids with no adjustment problems are kids in the light blue bars. The dark blue bars are kids with adjustment problems. If you happen to, this is a demonstration, is you happen to be a kid who comes in with some level of risk into a first grade classroom, and you sort yourself into a classroom that might be rated high, in this case on emotional support, those kids are making identical learning gains as the kids who are not who are coming in without adjustment problems. So again, the notion that what teachers are doing with kids really does matter in terms of closing achievement gaps. We've also done this in secondary schools, and we're seeing quite interestingly that even the kinds of attributes we observe between teachers and kids in their interactions show quite substantial prediction to kids' state standards tests. These are in Virginia schools using the SOLs in a current year and the following year, and we're now testing this in many thousand classrooms in a Gates-funded study. So we're seeing this kind of connection between what we're observing and kids learning across the board. So the next question becomes, can you improve those behaviors? Can you actually produce those behaviors that we're observing? And so we look very carefully at this issue of connecting outcomes and inputs. The class becomes the definition of teacher interactions that we want to produce. We have a video library where teachers can go and see others' interactions. Then we have a model of coaching that teachers get analysis and feedback on their own interactions. We've actually built a college course that produces these behaviors in students. All of these have been tested in randomized control trials and found to be effective. I'll just give you a couple of quick videos. This is an example of the videos that someone would see in the video library, giving them an idea of what it means to be effective in displaying a certain attribute using the class. When we coach teachers send us video clips. The coach analyzes those clips and posts those clips and analysis to a private website that the teacher then goes to. That loop repeats itself over the course of the year. When would be an example of the interface the teacher would see when she went to her private website. She'd be seeing herself in the video and getting the feedback from the coach, and then being able to insert her response to the coach's questions in that box at the bottom. As we've analyzed this, these are mean scores for treatment and control groups on observations across the year. This is the control group, no coaching. This is the group that got coaching, and you're seeing the movement in the interactions, the quality of interactions over the course of the year. And in fact, we see in classrooms in which the kids come in from higher concentrations of poverty backgrounds, the quality of interactions tend to erode across the course of the year. And in fact, our coaching buffers against that and actually heads that in another direction. When we've done this in high school, we see the same approach. We take the same approach with the coaching and video library. We've just completed a study of 100 classrooms across all content areas. The coaching improved teachers' instruction. The kids are more attentive, engaged. And the average kid, this is in Virginia, the average kid with a teacher who was receiving this coaching improved between the 35th and the 60th percentile on the state standards test score. So we're seeing, you know, a lot of effort around improving interaction translating into improved gains for kids. We're scaling this up in a number of different ways. I've mentioned the use in Head Start and in a number of different early childhood settings and in early and in high school as well. The challenge of scale is now our biggest challenge. So we think, our work so far has indicated that this idea of standardized and valid observations is something feasible and that can be scaled and integrated into improvement and management systems in school districts. We focus our performance measures and professional development on these interactions. We find that creates a common language and lens in a school or a school system that has a sort of synergistic effect for improvement. These experimental studies are showing that this focus can improve interactions and student outcomes. And now we're working in the world of accountability where incentives, merit pay, all the kinds of things we read about in the newspaper around improvement of schools are being applied to this particular instrument and domain of performance. So at least from our standpoint, we're really seeing some validity to this notion that observation can leverage improvements in teaching and learning. Thanks.
Okay. So the work that Yitna and I are going to talk about right now builds on research that has been done in the K through 12 teacher education context, that is the integration of technologies, especially video technologies, in teacher education to promote teacher learning and teacher reflection. But we found that this type of research is severely lacking in the context of higher ed. And we wanted to take a look at how to apply some of this work and build on some of this work in our own context of teacher education of graduate student teachers, in particular in my area of foreign language teaching. Activities that promote teacher development through reflection typically include things like self and peer observation, individual and social reflection, action research, and collaboration. However, although pedagogy courses frequently include processes to foster reflection, teacher educators have noted that novice teachers oftentimes fail to arrive at levels of reflection that are beyond descriptive and superficial due to their lack of experience or lack of guidance and support. Many times, novice teachers focus on mechanical aspects of their teaching, survival concerns, teacher actions, instead of focusing on student learning. Others have noted that novice teachers many times fail to provide evidence for claims in their reflections and writing. So, Yitna and I wanted to take a look at how we could harness video technologies to address some of those concerns with teacher reflection and teacher learning. How could we integrate video technologies in a pedagogy course, and how would they interact with other types of pedagogical tools that we normally use in the pedagogy course? So we took a look at my pedagogy course called Teaching Foreign Languages in my department, Spanish, Italian, and Portuguese. And we looked at data that we collected in fall 2009. In that semester, we had 13 graduate students who were enrolled in our MA or PhD program in Spanish or Italian, and also teaching at the same time in the same semester either elementary or intermediate Spanish or Italian. Many times, many of those teachers were teaching for the very first time ever. So in the pedagogy course, we normally include a variety of reflective assignments and activities and an action research paper. In this particular study, Yitna and I took a look at three particular activities that integrated video to spark reflection. And these are the three activities that I'm going to describe. The first activity asked students to, tied in with course topics and course readings that we were looking at during the semester. The best practices activity asked graduate students to view pre-selected video clips that came from our own course video archive that we had developed for many, many years of foreign language teachers teaching in our department. So graduate students took a look at those clips and reflected in a reflective essay online. And then they also, as a second step, did research in the video archive, selected their own video clip, edited it, and embedded the video clip directly into the reflective essay. This first activity, best practices, included three different assignments. The second activity asked students to videotape themselves, their own teaching, using a flip cam. They completed a reflective essay in two steps. First, based on memory alone, and then secondly, after having viewed their videotaped lesson, they reflected again. In this activity, the graduate students were asked to, after having viewed their video taped assignment, to select and edit particular clips and embed those clips directly into the reflective essay to use as evidence for the claims made in their paper, in their essay. In this particular assignment as well, graduate students were working together with a peer review partner and posing questions for the peer review partner directly in the essay, and the peer review partner commented using the commenting feature that we're going to show you shortly. In the third activity, the action research paper, which was a semester-long project for the graduate students, graduate students did research, did experiments, and reflected on an area of concern in their own classroom teaching. We asked them to videotape their classroom teaching and again to select, edit, and embed video clips directly into their action research paper as evidence for what they were talking about in their paper. This also included a component of peer review with their partner and a presentation on their research during class time. All of these assignments, these and other reflective assignments that we had in the course, were all shared and posted online on our eFolio page, which was directly embedded in our collab site. This includes as well all of the videos that were collected, and all of these assignments were collected together and formed part of the teacher's teaching portfolio at the end of the semester. Yitna's gonna come up and talk about the technology component.
Okay, so in a effort to use technology, obviously one of the biggest issues is how do you put tools together that are easy for students to use and carry on with these activities. The two tools we used are the eFolio and the flip cams for this course. eFolio is a tool that was developed here at the university, and flip cams are, of course, those tiny little cameras that you see everywhere these days. And of course, we also had to use Collab, which is the infrastructure that contained the activities of these two technologies. The eFolio is a document management tool. It's designed on the portfolio methodology based on the portfolio methodology. And it also has a discussion system that allows any product that a student produces to have a discussion board attached to it and thereby be converted to something that can be used for peer discussions, observations, and commentary by instructors or peers. eFolio also has a video editing system that is sort of simplified. It works on a streaming video process that allows the students to just simply provide the video fully and then online identify sections that they want to embed into their documents, again, to make it very flexible and easy to implement. FlipCam, as I said, is just a camera, very simple to operate, and students didn't have difficulty with it. We provided two training sessions, one for the video editing and the submission of their works, and then the second one for managing the portfolio, which is the sort of collecting and selecting and submitting certain items from the semester's work to comprise the portfolio with a cover page that on which they comment about the portfolio itself. I'm going to show you a couple of screenshots here of the tool. This one is a student page showing the eFolio. In the background is Collab, of course, the infrastructure, in which the eFolio tool is embedded, and we've extracted a particular student's work exemplifying best practices. There's a video embedded in the page and the text of the student's work around that video. This one is very similar, except the video is the student's own video, and you can't tell from here, but the camera, I think, is being operated by a peer, so there was also peer observation going on while videotaping the class. It's the instructor's selection, which is then embedded in her commentary about what she did. This screenshot is to show you the discussion that's been attached to the item that the student has submitted, and then commentary is added by peers or the instructor to that student work. And then this shot is an interior view of the system's portfolio. This is what the portfolio looks like for a particular student. You're seeing splayed out the pages that that student has submitted, about 7 or 8 documents, and then other students' entries could also be opened up to see what they have submitted. Each set starts with a cover letter that the student writes to describe why and what was put in the portfolio and why. And then on this screen, what you're seeing is the actual portfolio that the students have created and how it works outside of the eFolio system or Collab. What it does is it generates a zipped file that the students can walk away with at the end of the term of their portfolio. Now, the portfolio is displayed this way. It can be displayed in many other ways. This is the one we chose where the student's work is on the left-hand column. And then when you click on it, you see what the student has submitted, including the video that was submitted for that project. The other element here is that these portfolios are also collected and comprise a course portfolio, which the instructor can leave with. We really think that leaving a system with some product that you have produced, again, connecting to evidence and so forth, is very important. So these are not portfolios that have to reside in the system. They can be taken away by the person who created them. And the instructor also has a collection of the portfolio that the students created.
Okay. So Yitin and I collected a variety of data from that particular semester. Our primary data was the 65 reflective written assignments total from the semester. Wow, 1 minute. From these activities that we just described, and as well as secondary data that came from an anonymous online survey at the end of the semester. We videotaped a group feedback session on the last day of class, the final reflective essay of the portfolio, and course evaluations at the end of the semester. We coded the primary data using Hatton and Smith's levels of reflection that give four different categories for levels of reflection. Descriptive is obviously the most superficial level of reflection, whereas contextualized is the deeper level of analysis. And we have lots of results that I could share with you, but due to the fact that I have 1 minute left, I don't think I can humanly possibly do that. But in general, our results were very positive and showed that students' active use of video, in other words, their active use of selecting, embedding, and editing video directly into the written assignments, their essays, and action research papers, prompted deeper levels of analysis because it asked them to provide more accurate, concrete visual evidence, and it resulted in more specific reflections and more accurate reflections. The type of reflection and the amount of reflection varied and depended on the nature of the assignment, the focus on the self or on another teacher in the video clip, the intended audience of the assignment, and obviously the timing of the assignment during the semester. We see future applications of our work, both for us and outside of our department and among different departments around grounds. Obviously, this type of work could be applied to TA training in other departments or schools, or other professional development activities, whether that's self-assessment or workshops or mentorship, as well as a model for TAs or instruction or instructors in their own teaching. Thank you.
So hello, I'm Blair Gross, and I'm going to begin by introducing you to the Graduate Teacher Training Program in the Department of Psychology, and then I'm going to talk a little bit about some of our main objectives. So the Department of Psychology here at the University of Virginia has a large number of graduate student TAs. So there are approximately 90 students currently enrolled in the program. Of this, 53 students will have taught one semester this academic year, and of that, 36 students are actually teaching both semesters this academic year. Now, the graduate students in the program often express concerns about teaching, particularly the new and incoming graduate students, and you know, sort of, how do I teach undergraduates, and how do I teach effectively? Now, the university has some fantastic programs here to support teaching. There's the Teaching Resource Center and the Tomorrow's Professors Today program. However, there was a real concern that there was a lack of psychology-specific training, and especially for our new and incoming students. So the Graduate Teacher Training Program is a program that was designed and developed by current graduate students in the department. It's entirely student-run with the support of a faculty board of advisors, and it's a mandatory two-year program for the incoming graduate students. Now, the program has three main objectives. We'd like to sort of orient students to basic practical issues related to teaching undergraduates. We'd like to provide them with methods of teaching that they can implement directly, both now as teaching assistants, and then later on, hopefully in their careers as faculty members. And finally, we'd like to help students develop their own unique teaching style and teaching philosophies. So how do we orient students to basic practical issues? Well, one of the ways in which we do this is the program hosts a series of workshops each semester. The students can attend as many workshops as they like. However, they are required to attend at least one workshop in each of these categories. So we have student assessment, student learning, and then finally teaching techniques. So for example, we recently held a workshop on how to optimally motivate your students. Now, just a moment, an aside about the workshops. Eric is going to speak about this a little more in detail, but we do partner with the faculty at James Madison University and their Department of Psychology, and their faculty members are heavily involved, and they come over and they actually provide us with a lot of these workshops. And when I say workshops, I do mean workshops. So the students come and they're expected to engage in an open discussion about the issues. They often provide really hands-on interactive experiences so that students can really sort of get involved in problem-solving, troubleshooting, and learning about the topics that we're discussing. We don't just want students to come and go to the workshop and go home and forget everything that we've talked about, so we ask them to reflect on their experiences. So this is a sample, where this is our questions for reflection form that students have. And you can see that we're really sort of interested. We ask them questions like, what was one idea that you could immediately apply to your teaching? And how's your view of teaching be affected by this workshop? So the idea is that we're orienting these students to these issues, but we're also asking them to really engage in them and see, you know, really challenge themselves. How can I apply this, and what does this mean for my teaching? And so with that, Eric is going to talk about the rest of our objectives.
All right, so Blair covered the first main objective of the program, and I'm actually going to speak to you all a little bit about the second and third objectives. So our main second objective is to provide methods of teaching to implement directly as teaching assistants and faculty. And here I think it's very nice that our talk was led up to by Emily and Yitna's talk, because I think you'll notice excellent parallels between the two programs that we incorporate. So how do we do this? Well, first we incorporate a peer observation component. And here we randomly assign folks to four-person groups. And these are groups that are static throughout participants' tenure in the program. And each member of this four-person group actually takes themselves teaching twice, also through the use of flip cameras, which are awesome. In addition, each member provides feedback on a peer's teaching two times. So they're recording themselves teaching twice, then they're providing feedback twice. Finally, those being taped reflect on the experience, and I'll cover exactly what this reflection entails in a bit. In addition, participants create a course syllabus, which also satisfies departmental competency requirements in many of our areas. And finally, they attend teaching technique workshops and talks. All right. So here you see an example of a reflection on the peer observation component. So this would be filled out by the individual who taped themselves teaching. And though these are forms are, although we disseminate to them, to the participants, we don't mean them to be restrictive in any sort of fashion. They're just meant to be a guide. So you'll see some questions that we ask. For example, in what ways was the classroom observation useful to you? All right, so our third main objective is to help students develop teaching philosophies. And here is where we really have to thank our wonderful colleagues at James Madison University, who have kindly donated their time and resources to really get this program off the ground. So not only are the faculty members at James Madison University involved in excellent empirical training within the field of psychology, but they're also heavily involved with teaching effectiveness, and they publish in top teaching journals as well. So participants are asked to complete a reflective teaching statement through their participation in the program. And in order to do this, they attend several brainstorming workshops, and they also share drafts amongst themselves, but importantly, they share drafts with the JMU mentors. And this is really helpful because we feel that they really bring in a component of teaching focused practices that participants may not necessarily encounter here at UVA. All right, so how are we evaluating the effectiveness of our program? Well, firstly, we disseminate a preliminary survey at the beginning of each year. And this survey collects students' feelings on their teaching. It assesses their teaching experience, since many of our graduate students enter with varying degrees of teaching experience, and also serves as a baseline measure for future comparison. We also collect feedback from workshops that we put on, and also we have an anonymous feature on our CoLab page. So this point serves to continually evolve the program. So we're always seeking out ways in which the participants feel that the program could be improved. And hopefully we'll implement those improvements as it grows. Also, as I spoke about earlier, there's a peer observation reflection, as well as the workshop reflections that Blair mentioned. finally, there's a semesterly survey where students are encouraged to discuss how they plan to implement the ideas that they've learned from their experience in this past semester. And you'll notice that these prior points are all subjective in nature. We also wanted to obtain a more objective assessment. So in order to do so, we're also collecting course evals from undergraduates who have actually had taken classes with our program participants. And with that, I'll hand over the floor to Terry.
Okay, so I'm going to be closing today by sharing with you some of the data that we've collected thus far in the program. So the program is brand new. We started it just this year, and the data we're presenting today is actually just the first semester's worth of data. So we're looking at the baseline measure that our participants took upon entrance into the program, and then the measure that we had them fill out at the end of last semester, at the end of the fall semester. So while our data is rather limited, we're excited to share with you some of the trends that we've seen thus far. So the first big trend that we'd like to highlight for today is that it seems like our participants are highly motivated to reflect on their experiences within the program. So last semester, the most highly attended workshop was a workshop on student learning. And of those participants who attended that workshop, 75% chose to reflect on that experience. And then looking across all of the workshops that participants attended last semester, of those that attended a workshop, 76% chose to reflect on one of those experiences overall. So this is really important to us because it shows that our participants are thinking carefully about what they're doing. They're trying to integrate the stuff that they're seeing in the workshops, the ideas that we're putting across, into their own teaching philosophy and into their everyday approaches in the classroom. The next thing we'd like to highlight for today are any possible changes that we've seen in our participants over the course of the first semester. So what we've placed up here are actually some t-tests, and what this is looking at are these significant differences of students' reports on a Likert scale that we provided to them during the surveys. So all of these suggest that students' scores are significantly above neutral on the Likert scale. So what we're seeing is students over the course of the first semester, at the end of the fall semester, are still remaining positive on these several elements. So they still see themselves as effective teachers, they still see themselves as fair graders, and luckily they also still enjoy teaching after one semester. We also asked them to discuss some of the components of the program that they found the most helpful. And most commonly mentioned by our participants were the mentorship relationship with James Madison and the peer observation groups. However, we have seen some concerns remain across this first semester. So our participants still are concerned about some general issues related to grading, and they're also concerned about creating effective assessments for their students. So we hope to use this feedback to think about our future workshops, the future dynamics of the program, and how we can really provide training to our students, to our participants, that can address some of these issues. Other future directions that we hope to take. So by the end of this semester, we will have taken our second semester survey, our final one of this first year. And we also will have collected spring course evaluations from the undergraduates who have had our participants as teaching assistants and teachers. We hope to compile all this data to have a picture of our first year with the graduate teacher training program, and to think about how this data can help inform program efficacy, and also think about participant development over the course of this first year. We'll also be presenting some of this data at the Eastern Conference for the Teaching of Psychology at James Madison this summer. So finally, I'd like to close just with a couple thank yous to the many people who helped us get this program off the ground, without whom it would have been next to impossible. Our faculty advisory board within the psychology department, our mentors at James Madison, and then the Teaching Resource Center here at UVA and the Tomorrow's Professor Today program, who graciously provided us with a lot of resources. And finally, the Society for the Teaching of Psychology, who provided us with a small grant to start this program. Thank you very much. Thank you.